Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host. Thank you so much for being with us. It's always great to get to spend this time with you. And we're not taking calls this hour. We're doing all of our questions via the internet. We end up with lots of questions that have come into us either, well, the various modes of social media or emails or the various other ways you can contact a person via the internet. And so from time to time, we gather them up. We gather up especially the ones that are best, and we share them with Jimmy Akin, and Jimmy Akin answers them. And otherwise, Jimmy, I was just thinking about our first hour. Like, we're talking about Theravada Buddhism. We don't get calls on that too often. We're talking about, you know, explaining the historicity of the Exodus. We don't get calls on that too often. So it's nice to get to engage with these.
World religions and Egyptology are two of my areas of interest. So,
Yeah, the Egyptology stuff is fascinating. And you just think there's going to be they discovered a whole town recently. You probably know more about that than I do. But, like, there's big discoveries still going on in Egypt.
Yeah, and that one's kind of been overblown.
Oh, has it?
Yeah, it's actually an extension of a site that we've known about since the 1930s.
Oh.
And so it's not that amazing a discovery. It's also got advertised as lost golden city, and there's nothing golden about it. It's not, they didn't find a bunch of golden artifacts. It's not golden colored. It's mud brick, and it's a workers' camp. So it's not even royalty. There's nothing royal about it. And so, but because Egypt has a tourism problem right now.
Yeah, why not sell it? Yeah, I see what
exactly.
You're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is good that we found this extension of this site that we knew about, and archaeologists will be learning things from it. But it's not the most amazingest thing ever.
I see. I gotcha. All right. We're back to the internet then for more questions. John asks this in John chapter 1, verse 49. Nathanael first encounters Jesus, and his first reaction is to say, "Truly, you are the Son of God." What makes this different from Peter's confession, which caused Jesus to declare him the rock?
I think it's the difference is the context. It's not the fundamental content of what Nathanael says. Because if you keep reading, he not only identifies Jesus as the Son of God, but as the King of Israel, which means the Messiah. And even earlier in John 1, you have the two disciples, Andrew and apparently the beloved disciple, who say, we found the Messiah. And so you had an early awareness in John's gospel that Jesus is the Messiah and the Son of God, and thus the King of Israel is the Messiah. And those are essentially the things that Peter says in Matthew 16, when Jesus says, "Well, who do the people say that I am?" And they give a bunch of options, all of which are wrong. And he says, "Well, who do you say that I am?" And Peter speaks up and says, "You are the Christ," so there's the Messiah, "the Son of the living God." And there's the other thing that Nathanael says. So I think that Nathanael has recognized the same things that Peter has recognized. And I think that Jesus would say the same thing to part of the same thing to Nathanael that he said to Peter, which is, "Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven." It's the Father who's given him, both Peter and Nathanael, the grace to recognize Jesus as the Messiah and the Son of God, just like he gives that to all Christians. But what the difference is that in is the context in which Jesus is operating. This, in John 1, is at the very beginning of his ministry when he's first gathering disciples around him. He hasn't even picked the 12, much less is he at the point of the 12. Even though we have disciples recognizing content that will later, Jesus isn't at the point of setting up a structure in his church. But then, over the course of time, that changes. By the time of Matthew chapter 10, Jesus selects 12 of the disciples to be apostles. And so he has the beginning of a hierarchy in his movement. And then he gives it some time. to see how the 12 that he's picked work and what their natural talents are and things like that. And at a certain point, he decides, okay, given how Peter is functioning, he's the natural leader. And so he appoints the leader in Matthew 16.
Gotcha. Okay. So Nathanael is just a much, much earlier stage in the whole ministry when Nathanael encounters Jesus. But Robert has a follow-up question to, or at least a related question. So we'll follow it up to John's question. And that this also has to do with Nathanael. What was the significance of Jesus seeing Nathanael under the fig tree? Was it somewhere no one could possibly have seen him, thereby proving that Jesus must be God?
I don't think that it's necessarily that nobody could see Nathanael. I think it's that Jesus could not have humanly, by ordinary vision, seen Nathanael under a fig tree. I mean, maybe Nathanael had other people who were there with him. Maybe they were sitting under the fig tree with him too. And so maybe they could have seen Nathanael, but Jesus was not physically present. And so as a result, by natural sight, Jesus would not have been able to see Nathanael under the fig tree. And the fact he did see Nathanael under the fig tree indicates that he has more going on than what ordinary people do. And thus, it counts as evidence for his supernatural, paranormal abilities, which ultimately recognized as, oh, he's God incarnate. But that may not have been clear at the beginning. It could also have been, well, maybe he's a prophet, like when he displays preternatural knowledge of the woman at the well in John 4. But it does, the fact Jesus can do extraordinary things counts as evidence that he's somebody extraordinary.
All right. Thank you very much for the questions, both Robert and John. Appreciate that. I'm actually going to take a quick break right now. We got a little bit of sound issue we're going to straighten out. And so we'll take the break just a couple minutes early. Before we go to that break, I want you to avail yourself of the opportunity of getting a free ebook if you are so inclined. Over at shop.catholic.com, we try to have a free ebook each month. And right now, it's A Walk Through the Bible, free for you in the ebook format at shop.catholic.com.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Prayer has been so powerful in my communication with God, understanding the church better, most importantly, understanding the Lord better, and myself better. I heard it said once that God answers Knee-mail, as in K-N-E-E. Prayer is powerful. One of the favorite things I love to do when it comes to prayer is to ask for the intercession of the great saints. Try it sometime. You'll be very, very impressed and surprised by the amazing power of prayer.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book. He's the author of A Daily Defense, a great book for just getting short bits of very clear apologetics of the Catholic Church. A Daily Defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist. Jimmy gives you the objection, and then in a few paragraphs explains to you how Catholics respond to that objection. The author of many other books, as well as being our senior apologist here and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Today, not taking calls for Jimmy, but taking our questions from the internet. Lots of folks write to us from all around the world, and this is our opportunity to respond to those things, not just by a personal response to the person, but by addressing their question on the air. So won't be giving out the phone number, but lots of great questions ahead, I can assure you. Up next for Jimmy, Kathy's question. Kathy asks, what about us fringe Catholics who came to the faith late? Our marriages and family life are not Catholic, but I can't fix it. What do you say to Kathy, Jimmy?
Well, God understands. God knows the situation that you're in. Let's say you're married to someone who's not a Catholic and your children aren't Catholic. He knows that you can only do so much, and he has compassion and understanding for your situation, just like he did the very first Christians, because they were in that situation. You know, the people that St. Paul wrote to, whether they were Jewish or whether they were Gentile, they came to the faith late in life, so to speak. They frequently had non-Christian spouses. Their spouses were often pagan. Sometimes their children were not Christian as well. And so this is a situation that God knows about and cares about. He wants us to do what we can to evangelize our families. And that does not mean shoving the gospel down their throats. In fact, St. Peter and St. Paul urge wives in particular to be careful about how they evangelize their husbands and to even use their behavior as a way of winning the souls of their husbands to the faith rather than arguing with them about the faith. Similarly, one can teach one's children about the faith, but how much one can do that is going to depend on the age of the children and the attitudes of the children and what the attitude one's spouse has towards teaching the children about the faith. And so it's a complex situation, but God has compassion for this, and he only asks us to do what we can and not what we can't.
Kathy, I hope that's helpful to you, and I'm very grateful that you asked the question, because many, many people find themselves in that situation. You should not feel at all alone, and I hope that that was helpful to you, and I hope you'll contact us again if there are more issues you'd like me to address. It's Internet Open Forum this hour. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and I believe you are going to help me with this question, because I don't know what it means, Jimmy. Here's what Warren asks. Say there is an impending Teotwaki event. Could a bishop quickly ordain otherwise qualified laymen?
The end of the world as we know it.
Oh, the end of the world as we know it. Teotwaki. Got it. Okay, so I'm going to try that again. Say there is an impending, the end of the world as we know it event. Could a bishop quickly ordain otherwise qualified laymen as priests to assure the continuity of the church?
Yes, absolutely. You don't have to, in principle, you don't have to have any special training to be a priest. Now, you want to have training to be a priest, and you want to be trained very well. But in an emergency circumstance, just like it's possible to baptize a person with minimal instruction, it's also possible to ordain a person with minimal instruction. And so if in an end of the world as we know it type situation, a bishop could indeed take the best layman he can find and ordain them as priests or even bishops.
I would think when people write to you, they probably assume that you would know what Teotwaki means. But I don't think they would assume that. Do people just write to you in shorthand like that? Because they just figure, Jimmy Akin, he's going to know.
Well, frequently they do. That's one of the longer acronyms that I run across. And sometimes I have to look acronyms up, but that one I could figure it out based on the word event.
Oh, I see. I gotcha. All right. Back to the internet questions. Patty asks, what makes a mass invalid?
Okay, so invalid is not a category that pertains to the mass as a whole. The category that pertains to the mass as a whole is not validity, but liceity. Something is licit if it's done in accordance with the law, and it's illicit if it's done in some way other than what the law says. So masses can be licit or illicit, meaning you either follow what the law says or you don't in doing them. But the mass as a whole is not valid or invalid. What is invalid or valid within the mass is the consecration of the Eucharistic elements. So the things that you need to have for a valid consecration of the Eucharist are the same as for any other sacrament. You need the proper form, the proper matter, and the proper intent. And the proper form is the words of consecration, where the priest communicates, this is my body and this is my blood. Even if he varies a little bit from the prescribed formulas, that would make it illicit if he's deviating from the prescribed formulas. But as long as he gets out, this is my body and this is my blood, it's going to be valid. The proper matter is is wheat bread and grape wine. So if you've got wheat bread and grape wine, you have the proper matter. It, again, if you have some variation here, like let's say the bread is leavened, that would not be in accord with the law in the Latin rite of the church to use leavened bread, but it would still be valid. And in fact, in many Eastern rites of the church, they do use leavened bread. So having leaven in the bread wouldn't make it invalid, but it would make it illicit in the Latin rite. Finally, you need the proper intent, which is to do what the church does, to perform the Eucharist. And as long as those minimal conditions are met, this is my body, this is my blood, grape wine and wheat bread, and I'm performing the Eucharist, not staging it or something like that, you know, for a stage production, you're going to have a valid consecration within the Mass.
All right. Thank you very, very much for that question. Wait, now, who was that? That was Patty. Patty, thank you very much. Appreciate the question. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and lots of internet questions for Jimmy today on Internet Open Forum. Jacqueline asks this, Jimmy. I've been watching the series The Chosen, and I love it. There is a scene where Jesus changes the water to wine at the wedding. He tells his mother that it's not my time yet, then honors her request to change the water into wine. Should that wine be like the wine at the Last Supper? Was it his blood?
Well, I think that given the way John's gospel works, he's supplementing other gospels that he knows are already out there. That's clearly the case for Mark. I think it's also the case for Luke. Matthew, it's a little more debatable, but he's clearly supplementing what he knows is in the other gospels. And so he knows about the institution of the Eucharist at the Last Supper. He himself does not mention that. He does have an account of the Last Supper, but he doesn't go into the institution of the Eucharist because he knows that's in the other Gospels. And in light of that, I think that any miracle that Jesus does in John's Gospel that involves wine and transforming it into something being transformed into wine, I think he means us that John the author means us to understand this as in somewhat related to the Eucharist. So I think that for John, this is a foreshadowing of the Eucharistic miracle. It shows that Christ has the power to transform one substance into another, and the fact that he's doing it with wine points forward to the Eucharist, where he will transform the wine into his own blood. We also have a similar discussion in John 6 about Jesus being the bread of life and his flesh being bread, that also foreshadows the Eucharist and the transformation of bread into his literal flesh. So I think we have Eucharistic foreshadowing going on both in John 2 at the wedding of Cana and John 6 in the bread of life discourse. But I don't think in either case that we have exactly the same miracle. In John 6, for example, he's just fed the 5,000. He's just multiplied the loaves and the fishes. But on that occasion, even though it foreshadowed the Eucharistic miracle, it's not the same as the Eucharistic miracle. He doesn't turn, in multiplying the bread and the fish, he doesn't turn them into his own body and blood. So it may relate to the Eucharist, but it's not the same miracle. And in the same way, in John 2, at the wedding at Cana, the miracle is not the same. He's not turning wine into his blood. He's turning water into wine. And so once again, I think that even though it foreshadows the Eucharist, we shouldn't understand it as exactly the same miracle.
Jacqueline, thank you. Appreciate that question. It's an internet open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. All of our questions have come from the internet today, and Dan's question is up next. Dan asked this, Jimmy, what is an effective way to reach those who believe the end justifies any means, or that one person's desires trump another's? For example, some believe that abortion is killing a human being, but it should be allowed anyway, or that looting and rioting is okay for the disenfranchised.
I think that the ultimate solution in all cases of this sort is to encourage people one way or another to think about the golden rule, to put themselves in the position of those who are being affected by the desires in question and say, would I want this to happen to me? Like, for example, in the case of looting, put yourself in the position of the store owners that are being looted. They've built up businesses. They have limited margins to make money. They have to pay their employees. They have to make a living themselves. Is smashing up their shops and taking their stuff something that you would want to happen to you if you were a business leader or an employee of one of these stores? Similarly, in the case of something like abortion, put yourself in the position of the unborn child. Would you want to be aborted, or would you rather grow up and have the chance to live and experience life and make the same kind of choices that everybody else gets to make in life? The real solution to those, now this point can be made in different ways. Sometimes it can be made in a gentle way. Other times it can be made in a way that's a little bit sharper. Usually the gentle way, the giving it a loving presentation as something that people want to aspire to. We want to aspire to treating others like we want to be treated. That's a universal standard of fairness that's recognized across religions and across moral systems, that we should treat others. Even if you're not Christian, we all recognize we should treat others the way we want to be treated. And regardless of the way you make that point, I think that encouraging people to follow the golden rule is the key to sorting out these situations.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the question, Dan. It's an internet. We are just moving through questions, Jimmy. And so before we have to go to the bottom of the hour break, we'll take Jason's question. Is it egotistical to see something like autism not as a disability, but as a blessing? I do not know whether Jason himself has autism, but that seemed like that might be what he's asking.
So different people have different abilities and different disabilities that they have to deal with. Autism is one that some people have. Autism is a neurological difference that some people, and it can have effects like many other things. Among the more challenging aspects of autism are there can be a difficulty in relating to other people and communicating with them verbally. On the other hand, people with autism can be very focused on details and very detail-oriented and precise in what they do. And so it's a trade-off. There are benefits and there are detriments to it, like many other conditions. You even see this in literature, like Sherlock Holmes is clearly bipolar, but he uses that to his advantage as a detective. In the series Monk is clearly very heavily OCD, but he uses that to his advantage as a detective. And in the same way, people with autism can use aspects of it to their advantage. I recently saw a video on YouTube from a gentleman who has a science and technology channel I sometimes see. And he did a video called Autism is My Superpower, where he talked about both the benefits and some of the challenges of having autism. And so I don't see it as automatically egotistical, because there are these good aspects, but we also want to have a realistic understanding of some of the challenges that are involved too. And so Jason, you might want to, for you or a friend, you might want to check out that video on YouTube, Autism is My Superpower.
Thanks, Jason. I really appreciate that question. It's the, I mean, even something that is not, you wouldn't say is a good, you know, all kinds of suffering can be a blessing in that we might come to an insight we didn't have. We might be shared a grace. The God's grace helps us get through it. All of these are good as well. All right, I'm not exactly sure what happened with the sound, but Jason, I'm really very glad for your question. I'm grateful to everybody for their questions. We got a whole bunch more internet questions for Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. So hang on just a couple minutes. We'll take a very, very quick break. And when we come back, more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. And don't forget, we got that free ebook for you, A Walk Through the Bible, free in the ebook form right now at shop.catholic.com.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
According to divine command, we should give God worship, but how do we know if we're doing it right? Is worship a form of self-help to make me feel better, a form of social activism, or even a commodity? Or is it something that transcends all of those? In Real Religion, How to Avoid False Faith and Worship God in Spirit and Truth, Father Jeff Kirby cuts through the misguided modern notions about God and religion and takes you back to the foundation for true worship, God's revelation about himself. From his first contact with his chosen people to the culmination of his revelation in Jesus Christ, God shows us what religion is supposed to be like and how to make the practice of it a lifelong virtue in our lives. Order your copy of Real Religion by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Really, Sarah? You're just trying to be popular now. Two times with the groovy music. All right, you're popular with me. I find you very popular now. Thank you for playing the groovy music again. It's Internet Open Forum today with Jimmy Akin. All of our questions have come via the internet. No sound problems at all with that music. That sounded nice and clear and crisp. Thank you, Sarah. So I'm not going to be giving out the phone number. Just enjoy the questions, because actually when we get to gather them up from the internet, we get to collect some of the more interesting questions. So it provides an opportunity, I think, for present a little bit more of a challenge to Jimmy in a very interesting couple hours. So Internet Open Forum today. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, is our guest. And this next comes from Donna. And I know Donna. She's a good friend from Facebook. She's been to our conferences, so I've seen her here and there. And it's nice to get a question from you, Donna. Do you see the church growing? Do you see the church going underground soon? That's for you, Jimmy.
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. The The church is underground in some places. There are parts of the world where the church is not able to operate fully above ground because of persecution by the local authorities. And it's unfortunate, but in many parts of the world, not in all of them, there is a growing hostility towards the Christian religion and towards the Catholic Church. And so I anticipate that there will be additional places where the church will have to shift at least part of its operations to a realm that's not fully in the public eye. Now, even during the original age of persecutions, there was a knowledge out in the public that Christians existed and that they were doing their thing, but they were keeping it largely private and trying to stay under the radar. I would anticipate the same thing would happen in various places in the future. Fortunately, this isn't happening everywhere, but there is a concern that it's becoming more widespread and Christians are having to be more on the down low about some aspects of faith and practice. It's a very worrying thing. Fortunately, here in the United States, we have the First Amendment, which is meant to guarantee religious freedom. How consistently that will be interpreted and enforced is an open question for the future. And so I think it's very important for Catholics and other Christians and other people of other religions to be very active in the public sphere in ensuring that we continue to have religious protections that the courts will actually enforce.
Amen to that, brother. Donna, thank you very, very much for the question. And thank you for all the time. So, well, just thanks for being our friend here at Catholic Answers. David asks this question, Jimmy. Why does Scripture and other public revelation end with the death of the last apostle, considering that, one, some of the New Testament is not authored by an apostle, and two, additional apostles can be appointed by Christ, much as Paul was appointed by Christ after his ascension? What do you say to that, Jimmy?
The answer is that it's purely a matter of God's choice. As you point out, God could have Scripture, which forms part of public revelation, written by non-apostles, and he could continue to appoint additional apostles like Christ appointed Paul. So the fact he chose not to do those two things is a matter of his choice. Now, we can speculate on the reason for that. I would speculate that he had already completed, that it was fitting for him to end public revelation at that point because he'd already said what he wanted to say for the Christian age. There wasn't any new public revelation that we would need prior to the second coming. And so, well, he'd said what he meant to say, and therefore he didn't need to say any more. He didn't need to keep appointing apostles or keep giving public revelation. I think that's the fundamental reason, but it's a matter of speculation.
Thanks, David. Thank you for the question. Up next, one from Tom. And this is a very concise question, I got to say, Jimmy. Do lockdowns actually work?
It's going to depend on a number of factors, including what kind of lockdown you're talking about. There is a wide range of different kinds of lockdowns. Some of them are extreme, like nobody gets to go outside of their homes at all. Others allow for a lot more flexibility, where people get to go out, but they need to be socially distanced or wear masks or all kinds of other things. There's not a single model of what a lockdown looks like. Then you have to evaluate another term in the question, which is work. What do you mean by work? If you mean prevent the transmission of COVID or some other, pathogen in society, well, yeah, if you have a severe enough lockdown, it will contain the spread of COVID or some other pathogen. I mean, people might get it in a single household, but if they're locked in their household and can't go out at all, they're not going to be spreading it to other households. So there is a form of lockdown that is so severe that, yeah, it would work to contain the spread of a particular pathogen. But what's the cost of that? If you don't let people go out of their homes, period, how do they get food? And how do they get medical care? And are they going to go crazy? And are they going to suffer mental illness or other physical illnesses? And so there is a cost benefit calculus that has to be done. And I think because of how the COVID debate got politicized in American society, and because of how risk intolerant many people are today compared to the past, that there wasn't enough thought put into this question. You had an initial 2 weeks to flatten the curve that then turned into months and months and months of lockdown. And the science really hasn't been clear that the type of lockdowns that were used either worked to contain the spread of the virus or that they didn't have hidden costs that were counterbalancing the utility they had with regard to COVID. I think it's a complex question. It's one that there needed to be a lot more public debate about, and we really didn't have that. So I think that given the lack of clarity in this situation, we'll have to kind of look at it in hindsight and see what judgments can be made at a later date.
Tom, thanks very much for the question. Appreciate it. We didn't really have the political debate, but I wonder, Jimmy, if in coming weeks and months and years, there will be, you know, enough scientific studies done where we'll start to get a clear picture of what worked, what didn't work, and we can have that debate because this might happen again.
Oh, it's certain to happen again at some point. And I think it's important that we learn the lessons from this time to the extent we can and try to get past all the political partisanship and take an objective look at the science and what we learned. That's one reason I'm glad Sweden didn't follow the same kind of lockdown as everybody else, because it provides another data point about
exactly
what happens if you do something different.
Right. Right. And there's going to be I'm sure there'll be 100 PhDs, theses, I'm not exactly sure how you're supposed to say it, written over in the next couple decades that have
theses
that have take a look at some different aspect of this pandemic, because certainly some stuff went right. A lot of stuff also went wrong in the way we did it. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
I feel like God has been really doing a work in me in the last 5-10 years. I'm a convert to Catholicism, and I started to just really feel a passion to know more about the Catholic faith, and I started listening to Catholic radio all day. I'm not doing great things, but I'm doing small things with great love.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Internet Open Forum. Having fun with Jimmy Akin, Senior Apologist here at Catholic Answers. Lots and lots of internet questions come to us. Gather them up every now and then and try to work our way through the mailbag. Jimmy is gracious enough to do that with us from time to time. Tomorrow, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World will be about a secret government program in the 1960s that tried to get us into a war with Cuba. I don't remember the name of it, Jimmy, but I think I gave the right summary. Did I sum it up right?
You did, and it was called Operation Northwoods.
Of course, Operation Northwoods. You always try to give it a nice, Irenic-sounding name. You don't want to call it Operation Fake Terrorism to get us into a war with Cuba. You don't want to do that.
Yeah, the Joint Chiefs of Staff obviously had a sense of marketing.
Yeah, right. You want to market your plots correctly. All right, I got another question from another Tom. a question from another Tom. This Tom asks, would a DNA test confirm that Joseph was Jesus's father?
Well, in fact, Joseph was not Jesus's father. So regardless of what a DNA test showed, it wouldn't confirm that he was his father. Now, you could, since we don't know exactly what Joseph's DNA was, and we don't know exactly what Jesus's DNA was, there could be a range of outcomes, hypothetically speaking, to such a test. We know that Jesus inherited DNA from Mary in modern terms because she was his biological mother, but women don't carry a Y chromosome, and you need a Y chromosome to be a man. So somewhere, God came up with additional genetic material that he added to Mary's in order to give Jesus a full set of human chromosomes. That could have been as little as a single Y chromosome, or it could have been a whole set of 23 additional chromosomes in addition to the 23 that Jesus would have inherited from Mary. So what would those 23, let's suppose it was a full set, what would those 23 have looked like? Could they have been identical to the genetic matter that would show up on a DNA test of Joseph? Well, hypothetically, they could. God could create 23 new chromosomes from nothing and add them to Mary's, and they could look identical to Joseph's chromosomes. But that would defeat the purpose of having Jesus not have a human father. If you then give Jesus DNA that looks exactly like the DNA of his foster father, if you had a test like this, it would make it look like he is the biological son of Joseph, and that defeats the whole point. So I would suspect that if we had Joseph's DNA and if we had Jesus's DNA and we could compare them, they would not look identical.
All right, Tom, thanks very much for the question. Next one comes from Deacon Harvey. What's up with Psalm 110? Why do different Bibles have somewhat different versions?
The reason is that the Psalms are numbered differently in different editions of the Bible. The Masoretic text is the version that is used by Jewish people, and it's the most common one today in English Bibles for the numbering of the Psalms. But the Septuagint has a slightly different numbering, where some psalms get joined together or split up a little bit differently. They both come out, both the Septuagint version and the Masoretic text have 150 psalms, but they're combined and separated in slightly different ways. And as a result, you see the numbers getting out of alignment and coming back into alignment and getting back out of alignment again at different points in the book of Psalms. So if you ever look up a reference to a psalm and you see something that is not what you're expecting, look at the psalm immediately before or immediately after it, because the variations will be like one off from the number you're expecting. So just look at the next psalm before or after, and you'll find what you're looking for.
Thank you, Deacon Harvey. Appreciate the question. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Internet Open Forum. And Patrick asks this, Jimmy, have you heard of the theory that the Last Supper was on a Tuesday because Jesus and the apostles went along with an older calendar like the Essenes surely did? And that way, it reconciled John's Passover of the Jews as distinct from it. According to this, Jesus would still be crucified on Friday, but it would reconcile some New Testament difficulties like all the trials, and not to mention the synoptic versus John's account.
There are a number of theories along these lines, and I have encountered one that talks about the Last Supper occurring on a Tuesday. Pope Benedict actually explores this in Volume 2 of his Jesus of Nazareth series. I don't know that he's exploring exactly the version that you're thinking of, though, which has the Last Supper on a Tuesday or Passover on a Tuesday and then Jesus being crucified on a Friday. I don't see how that would solve the issue that people raise with Joannine chronology, because if he's crucified on Friday, then the Jewish authorities, according to John's gospel, are still waiting to eat the Passover on that Friday. And if Passover was Tuesday, I guess I can see how this could explain some of those things. The more common theory along these lines that I've seen is that he was crucified on Wednesday, and that allows additional days to happen before he's raised on either Saturday night or Sunday morning. And people propose that as a way of trying to explain the statement that he'll be buried for 3 days and three nights. Actually, I'm not a fan of any of these theories. I think the traditional dating of Passover being on Thursday and the crucifixion being on Friday and the resurrection early Sunday morning is the correct chronology. I think that the 3 days and three nights is accounted for by the fact that back then, part of a day or night got counted as a whole one. So if he's buried for part of Friday, all of Saturday, and part of Sunday, that will be spoken of as 3 days and three nights in the Jewish idiom. And I think that the reason that the Jewish authorities had not yet eaten Passover on Friday morning is because they stayed up all night waiting for Jesus to be delivered to them and then putting him on trial. They hadn't had time to eat it yet.
Patrick, thank you very much for the question. Jimmy Akin, our guest, Internet Open Forum. Jeff asks this: do you think God's original plan for Moses was for him to just become Pharaoh through succession and then have Moses and his army escort his people into the promised land? But Moses messed up and murdered an Egyptian, and so God had to find another way.
So this is an interesting question that also involves Egyptology like we had in the last hour. One could propose this, and it's an interesting idea to think about, but I don't think it's very likely because of how Egyptian courts worked, royal courts, I mean. Moses, even though he was adopted and raised by Pharaoh's daughter, he was still recognized as being a Hebrew, as being a foreigner. That's how. So he knew about his own people. That's why he ends up defending the guy and murdering the guy who was attacking a fellow Hebrew. And it's unlikely that the native Egyptians would have allowed a Hebrew, even an adopted Hebrew, to become Pharaoh. Also, how you became Pharaoh didn't depend strictly on what kind of a son you were. It appears from various things that Egyptologists have learned that what was actually more important was who you married. The person who became Pharaoh was the one who married the woman with the most pure royal blood. And so hypothetically, if Moses could have married the highest ranking Egyptian woman of the right age with the most royal blood in her veins, well, then maybe he could have become Pharaoh because that's how other people did it. But we don't have any indication that that was the case. Also, older sons tended to inherit rather than younger sons. And we don't have any indication that Moses was counted as Pharaoh's oldest son. He was presumably a younger adopted son and a foreigner, and all of those would be strikes against him becoming Pharaoh. And you may wonder about how does this work with older sons tending to inherit unless they died, with the idea you need to marry the woman with the royal blood? Well, that's why King Tutankhamun married his sister. So they had brother-sister marriages that were incestuous to accommodate both the principle of older sons tending to inherit with the principle that you needed to marry the woman with the royal blood.
All right, Jeff, thank you for that question. I'm just going to keep moving here because we're getting very near the end. I don't want to get everybody's question in if I can, or just at least get as many as I can. And James asks this: is there a formal process to have a patron saint named for a profession? My military occupation deals with chemical defense, and I would like to have Saint Benedict named as our patron, the way artillerymen have Saint Barbara.
So who gets to be the patron saint of something depends on what you're talking about. If you're baptizing a baby and you give the baby a saint's name, the parents or whoever names the baby are establishing one of the patrons for that child. If you have a church that's being built, it's the person who chooses the name of the church, which would presumably be either the bishop or the initial pastor of the church, with the approval of the bishop, who determines the patron saint of that church. If you're talking about the patron saint of a nation, it's the conference of bishops that determines that. So it would seem to me that for a profession like chemical defense, it would be Catholic chemical defense workers that would be the ones to propose this. And then in order to give it legal recognition, I would assume you'd talk to the competent military authorities. So if I were in the U.S. Armed Forces and I was doing chemical defense, I might talk to some other chemical defense guys and build some support for having St. Barbara declared as our patron, or St. Benedict, I'm sorry, declared as our patron. And then I would talk to the military archdiocese of the United States and say, hey, we have a movement. We'd like St. Benedict to be our patron. Would you consider formally recognizing this?
Thanks, James. Ryan asks this, Jimmy. In chapter 3 in the Gospel of Nicodemus, Jesus being questioned by Pilate is identical to how John's Gospel presents it. But after Pilate asks Jesus what is truth, Jesus replies, truth is from heaven. Pilate says, therefore, truth is not on earth. Depending on the time frame of when this Gospel was written, do you think it's likely this shows an accurate portrayal of the conversation Jesus and Pilate have beyond what John's Gospel records?
So I think Ryan has identified the key question, which is the time frame when this was written, because the exact details of conversations are not going to be passed down for multiple generations with any degree of accuracy. If a conversation occurred, 200 years ago, if we don't have a written record of it, we might at best have the gist of what people talked about, but we're not going to have their exact words. And so unless the Gospel of Nicodemus were a first century gospel, we would not expect it to have exact details of the conversation of Jesus and Pilate. And in fact, the Gospel of Nicodemus is not from the first century. It appears that it may have been composed in the 4th century, in the 300s AD. It may draw on earlier sources, but it doesn't appear that any of those sources are 1st century ones other than the Gospel of John itself. So it looks like an imaginative embellishment of John's Gospel on this point rather than an independent record of an actual conversation.
Oh, how interesting. So give me, in case I missed it, I think I did miss it. You dated the Gospel of Nicodemus then when?
To the 300s AD.
Oh, 300s AD. Okay, so I see. All right, Richard asks this, and I think we have time. Is heaven an actual place or is it a spiritual relationship with God?
Heaven is definitely a spiritual relationship with God, but it also, at least in its present form, is capable of receiving bodies. Because we know of several people who are in heaven that have their bodies with them. That would include Elijah, Mary, and Jesus himself, because he took his body with him when he ascended to heaven. So it may not be a place in our physical universe. It may not be extended in space the way we are, but it's at least capable of receiving a physical body. Of course, as we mentioned earlier in the show today, our ultimate destiny is to live on the new earth, which will be renovated, and we'll have our bodies with us there as well.
So that being the case, if heaven is definitely a spiritual condition, it's also a place that can receive bodies, so it has some spatial reality. When we live on the new earth, the spiritual sense of heaven is still ours. Even if we're not in that physical location of heaven, we're still in heaven. Is that right?
Yes. Spiritually speaking, yes. We will be spiritually united with God in the new earth.
All right. It's good news. I like getting clear answers on these last things. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World will drop tomorrow with a new, each Friday, you get a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. This will be episode 151, probably something like that.
Right, 151.
Episode 151 tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World about the Northwoods program project. Sounds kind of creepy to me, but get it and enjoy it. Jimmy, thank you very much for 2 hours of Internet Open Forum.
My pleasure, Si.
We'll have to do it again, and we will do it again. So if you are one of those folks who communicates via the various internet forms, if you send us an email or contact us via social media, it's always possible we'll get to it when we do these. And if you've got a weird question that you specifically want when we do weird questions with Jimmy, just send it to us at radio@catholic.com. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.